Welcome to the Cyber Divas podcast season, fall season 2019. You must have heard all the wonderful podcasts from summer 2019. We are continuing the themes of intersectionality, pass the mic, digital publics in the fall season as well. Our first guest for this season, our first guest who now becomes a cyber diva with us for this season is Swati Kamble. Swati, can you introduce yourself, please?
Hello, Radhika. Thank you. So I am Swati. As Radhika said, I come from Maharashtra, India, and I'm based in Brussels now. I'm doing my PhD from the University of Geneva, which is based in Switzerland. But my family is from Brussels, so I live here with my husband and my baby. My PhD research concerns the movement that has fascinated me, that has shaped me, the movement of lower caste people called Dalit movement. And I'm looking at the Dalit women's movement that has come up as a, that has been critical in the time in the 90s when I was growing up. It created a critique and contested the lack of Dalit woman specific representation by the Dalit movement, which was male and masculine, and the feminist movement, which did not look at the intersectional identity of Dalit women, as we know from Black feminist articulations of intersectionality. Dalit women took inspiration from that and have been talking about their specific identity for historically even. There are evidences in the 19th century where Mukta Salve articulated about the troubles, intercaste troubles that Dalits face, but also women, Dalit women suffering. Yeah, so, but basically, what I'm writing about is how this vast Dalit women's movement has now even influenced, impacted grassroots women who seek, you know, their rights, and how they maneuver through the bureaucratic processes and seek their space in policy making and the benefits coming from the schemes and programs of the government. So basically looking at the grassroots women and advocacy lobby work of Dalit women activists.
So that's fascinating. So Swati, what you are saying is that in one sense, you're moving beyond the perception that all Indian women of let's say rural women and others are lumped together as needing development, but you are trying to show how, you know, that's the perspective, that's the development model, right? Where yeah. there is, at least in the literature as it's spoken of, there is a almost a disappearance of the fact of caste as a factor yeah. that plays, that still plays, and caste is often yeah. spoken of in a lot of literature, so that those of us who have had a lot of our postgraduate education in the West encounter caste as a historical situation, unless we specifically encounter works such as yours or others who are talking about the Dalit feminist struggle. Yeah. And movements that are contemporary. So what you are then saying is that the that caste across time, caste has shifted, but has shifted in the context of India in certain ways, and it just shifted in a way that it still prevails.
Yeah.
And so what you are trying to recover is the agency of the Dalit woman and her ability to interact with and change situations and hierarchies. Yeah,
you have rightly stated how caste and Dalit women specifically are seen from the context of this a population in need of developmental assistance and aid, and caste is a sociological concept term set in history rather than how it plays out today, even in the lives of people that are living, breathing, and struggling, that discrimination and stigma. What I am trying to say is that through this long-standing legacy, history of movement, you can see evidences of Dalit women being the leaders, the champions for anti-caste, as well as women's rights, democratizing the spaces for everybody, for women, for Dalits. And that legacy should be seen in today's context, when Dalit women living in the slums and rural parts are seeking benefits. They are not these women that are beneficiaries of the programs only, but they are the ones who are change agents. They are the ones who are by their maneuvering and navigation through these bureaucratic, highly masculine, upper caste spaces, they are creating their own space. And that creation of space and their approach comes from this history that they have legacy to.
What you're also saying then is, if you're talking about Dalit women's action in those development spaces, they're also creating space for others. It's not
absolutely
purely for Dalit women. So we can't really, as we've discussed in past conversations, we can't really talk about it as self-contained cubicles. But the most prevalent understanding of caste in a majority of mainstream India even is in relation to the equivalent almost of affirmative action in the United States, which is the reservation. And so that's actually not what you're looking at. You're looking at the Dalit women in these development spaces and their labor in producing models of development almost for the women in these areas needing development.
They become, in the process, champions for other marginalized groups and women. So that's my argument. And
fantastic.
The other important argument is that, this I borrow, the danger of single story, I borrow this from Chimamanda Adichie. When you look at woman clad in sari in rural parts, hardworking laborer, or in urban slums, a domestic worker, you would write her off as a poor woman, illiterate, uneducated, and you position her as a passive person that doesn't have any agency, but don't paint that, single picture, that narrative, and look at it critically. That's what I have experienced as a researcher, going back to my community where I came from, where I was surrounded by women like my mothers, my sisters, my aunts and cousins, who were these illiterate women who were trying to make their ends meet. In that process, they are as empowered as any other feminist that you would see lobbying and advocating for the rights of her people, her community. And that's what I have seen. And this other side of the story I wanted to bring up to the people through my research.
Excellent. There's a lot we can be talking about in relation to this as it connects up to feminist work in development studies and in relation to discussion of how women are agents of change and in relation to local practices and place-based practices. And so what you are talking about then is this very micro, very contextual, I wouldn't say not necessarily micro, because it funnels outwards, right? And
absolutely.
This is what we as academics are not mapping enough of. And this is how, by not mapping these particularities, we feed into work that is very neo-colonial. And and even when we claim to be doing feminist work, our work feeds into a global patriarchy almost.
So, and
as I'm responding to you, I'm also thinking through, and that's the whole purpose of this podcast, that we as the Cyber Divas will be thinking through these issues. So let's pause on that very, very rich work that you are doing, and which we will pick up on as we continue our collaborations, and think about and return to the key question for this podcast, which you've already addressed in certain ways, which is, what do you think of when you think in terms of the term, the concept of intersectionality?
I would say I'm obsessed with this term and unpacking it and how it has. I have traveled with this term as a novice in 2007 when I first heard about this term spoken by a professor, and she handed me a book by Indian scholar, and that's when I got to know that it emerges from a Black feminist movement, and then my understanding deepened, and now I like the idea of intersectionality, like thought, which is written by Anjumarie Hancock, who looks at Indian feminist Savitri Phule, her works, and she says that look at that historical context of 19th century where a woman sets out against all the odds to educate other women and lower castes, and that was in her ways of writing and speaking and working for the rights of the marginalized, she was doing intersectionality. And those intersectionality-like thoughts have existed globally. And wherever there have been marginalized populations, those populations have created through their knowledge, the indigenous knowledge or local knowledge, articulations that are intersectionality-like. And I like it a lot because she also says that, you can't, even though intersectionality as a term was coined by Kimberly Crenshaw, critical race theorist, feminist, Black feminist, Anjumarie Hancock, who is also a Black feminist, she says that this is a concept that you cannot give time or history into. You can find the thoughts like intersectionality across history and histories of marginalized, and that's what we have to embrace. And that is interesting for me to then unpack this allyship, which is quite interesting for me, as coming from a marginalized community, Dalit community, and now I like to call myself an intersectionality feminist, a Dalit feminist with intersectionality understanding. I think that there is so much potential in this concept theory paradigm, not only in academia, but in politics, wherein, like Kimberly Crenshaw says, what we have right now, the marginalization, discrimination, and stigma are all results of intersectionality failures, failures to understand that these structural, it's not the identities, it's not the multiple identities, but the structures that create, the structures created by caste, race, and gender that perpetuates and continues the inequalities. And we have to talk about these structures and how they interact with each other and co-create, mutually co-construct the handicaps and discriminations. So it's a fascinating concept which I have tried to embrace in these years, decades, and seen it develop and seen it getting debated, contested, and still hold its ground. So I really find it an important term.
It almost seems like, starting with your description of your own research and interests and your work, down to your discussion right now of Hancock's connecting with Poole and her role in her time in educating women, it almost sounds like you are talking about it being a very commonsensical thing in a women's space. As how else would we be but intersectional?
Absolutely.
To negotiate the complexities of, let's say, complexities of that are very embodied in our practices, negotiating the abstractions of being away from the nitty-gritty. For instance, as I see you negotiating your baby on the one side and your studies on the other, and also this very, very, just as I was listening to you, your very complex, even speaking manner, which I think reflects your years in, did you do your graduate work in Netherlands?
I've been all around the part of the world.
It's almost like I'm hearing so much intersectionality in the way you speak, even. But when perhaps somebody from a context that has not heard as many global ways of speaking in English as I've traveled, might immediately assume, looking perhaps at a picture of you, that your quote-unquote accent is a backward Indian accent. Mm-hmm. First of all, Indian accents, wherever they come from, are not backward. But yet, what the interesting thing is, I can hear various intersections in the way you speak. And it looks like in your research, you are mapping how it is almost commonsensical not to, and what it's almost what you're saying is that in our writing practices, we make disappear so many things that in our embodied everyday life, we insist on intersectionality. It's almost a necessity.
I agree. I mean, this language is a tool right now for me to bridge these two worlds, the world that I come from, slum deprivation, where my mother still goes for court hearings, that would ensure that she's not evicted from the, where, by the way, my siblings and his family lives too, so that they do not, you know, suffer eviction. My father was a mill worker, a laborer, and he was raised, born and raised in that little workers' quarters, mm-hmm. and his third generation was born there, his grandson was born there, and all he ever wanted was, you know, move out of there, move upwardly in the class, in class sense at least, and educate his kids. And, you know, we studied in vernacular medium, and right now when I heard you talk about my language, it just hits home again. That there's so much baggage we carry, the burden of these identities that are imposed on us by unequal structures that I spoke of earlier.
And some of this is just because people who implement policy just want data in a very flattened form. And I'm mm-hmm. sure we can talk about this, map this back into colonial times when statistics mm-hmm. were offered up to kind of describe something, and in mm-hmm. order to feed that into how policy or governing could happen. But that's a whole mm-hmm. other discussion that we can enter into.
Absolutely.
In the long term.
Absolutely.
One of the things, Swati, you and I were also talking about is in terms of intersectionality and the digital publics, which we always inevitably end up with talking about roundabout mm-hmm. at some point in our podcasts, is hashtags that go around, hashtag publics, where coalitions around hashtags. So we have coalitions around hashtags of mm-hmm. people of color, hashtag POC, mm-hmm. and then we have coalitions around hashtag anti-caste. We have mm-hmm. coalitions around, let's say, hashtag Dalit women fight. And I'm just mm-hmm. throwing these out just from memory. And we have hashtags around hashtag black indigenous people of color, which would be BIPOC. So mm-hmm. How, as these are coalitionary spaces, mm-hmm. but they also serve to, again, talking about the contradictions between how our everyday practices sometimes are essentially force us to be intersectional in our coalitional goals, but also how then feeding back into a digital public, sometimes we have to move into speaking to the computer, so to speak, through hashtags that mm-hmm. might flatten the identities. I'm just drawing a huge kind of a, you know, landscape here, and it's impossible to address all of it. But or I don't even know if I'm making any sense. But you know that we
I understand
writing about these as we speak. So if you want go ahead.
No, it's quite interesting. Like coming back to, like, we have been talking about intersectionality, and within it, how these virtual spaces have become these digital local communities where people are coming together based on identity of people of color, wherein then you are kind of erasing or hiding other complex identities that are, identities that you embody. And same with Dalit women. So I think all of us who are striving for this intersectional conversation should, on these virtual spaces, claim, shout out in solidarity to say that, you know, we know that we all in this space who are hailing from marginalized groups, we should say that there are complexities to our identities, to our narratives, to our histories, and we should say that we don't understand, but we acknowledge that there is a difference, that there is not only the difference, but that there are complex complexities. I don't want to mince other words to describe that. And in saying that, what we do is we invite ourselves and others to be reflexive. And intersectionality greatly talks about this reflexivity in the academia, but in political intersectionality too, I think we should really, in this era of trending and traction and all the terms that we talk in digital language, we should also slow down and say that how can we try to understand that hashtag is a mean, an invitation to more complex dialogue, and let's not reduce it down to anti-caste, hashtag Dalit women's rights, but what entails it?
So what you might be suggesting is that these are strategic coalitions. And coalitions that should not be perceived as building walls, but as opening up.
Absolutely.
They're not really, these are permeable. They're not really, so somebody who has a hashtag by Black, Indigenous, People of Color hashtag could also be part of a hashtag anti-caste.
I would say that in an ideal world, we can strive towards that. I would say that because right now what's happening, and you see it everywhere, that by necessity or by this historical context where the marginalized communities, essentially Dalit in Indian context, Dalit women, did not have platforms. And when they are, the young population is getting this virtual platform, they are embracing their identity and they are saying that we will define our politics, our narratives, our voices, and we do not want to be the subject of, the others' research, the others representing our voices. And in saying that, they're not saying we do not want allyship. They are saying that let us articulate. We are creating spaces, which is important, which is necessary. And on the other hand, there should be that understanding that, there is this historical backlog, and that we have to acknowledge. And I am really saddened that Indian academia, Indian feminism has not had that maturity to create a platform wherein they would stand up and say, not guilt-ridden, not filled with guilt, but with responsibility, say that, we understand that that has not happened, that the creation of spaces together has not, a dialogue hasn't happened, and how can we?
So what you are saying is, rather than disappear them because you're so guilty for your past histories,
that frozen
you want
in guilt,
to either be dev, exactly, that's ridiculous, right? To be frozen in guilt in such a way that you're not able to hear the present moment. And this is again what we were talking about earlier, as this is why this podcast series is ending up to be a sort of a set of archives of the present, almost, that we are talking about what is currently happening. And so we don't have to constantly have to disappear these issues, these intersections, because there was a past history. Then we become no better than our ancestors, who very consciously reinstituted the platform, even if we say, oh, but I meant it well. I can mean it well, but I can still reproduce some of the hierarchies. And I need to, from what I can see of the many, mostly Dalit women I have seen on Twitter and on Instagram, I don't hear them saying as, when they are stating their agency, as you said, we will tell our own stories. Who else but each of us can tell our stories? And if I have direct access to a place where somebody can hear me, why don't I tell it myself? And so allyship and translation of these stories has to be done, I'm thinking, in the current moment of academia, with far more dialogue, with far more engagement, and acknowledging that some people may have different kind of training and different kind of languages to work through and connect with different kinds of platforms. So your work, for instance, you will be translating a lot of what is already happening into academic language, because there is academia doesn't exist in a vacuum. Academia is translating a lot of this itself to policymakers or to the larger public. But what is interesting about, for instance, the digital publics like Twitter is that perception of direct speech to the world, which I think in one sense subverts and redirects the energy outwards, away from, you don't have to take into account that middle person feminist who wasn't listening to you in the Indian space, and you feel like you can make direct connections to the transnational public. Am I getting anywhere close?
I think that politics for a certain time period, for certain context, it's okay, it's good, and I want transcendence from going beyond that too, you know, because
you mean going beyond even the transnational digital publics?
Using the transnational digital public spaces, going beyond this, I don't need a mediation to talk. I can talk myself.
Yes.
But then now I'm shutting doors on, like in both sides, the frozen in guilt front says that, oh,
you speak for yourself.
Saying that there are two sides, and in these two sides you would see that the frozen in guilt side says, let them do their politics because they want to speak their stories,
and I won't do anything.
This side, and then there is no, like we said earlier, dialogue. So my idea would be that transcendence would be that, you know, we step by step in academia and feminism using these platforms just have a dialogue and just not just, because if it was just then it would happen, but I think I am very happy with this cyber divism or activism that is taking place here. With that, younger generation is very direct, does not mince words and does not beat around the bush and comes straight to the point and says, hey, there is no harm in just opening up a discussion.
Good.
And then you have an article coming on the round table or Savri in Indian, in the Dalit context, or now these alternate news magazines that are online, like coming online, the Wire, Newsmin, or I don't know, there are several where people can access and write about. And in this decade, I have seen people that were shy to openly state their ideas because they thought they, amongst the Dalit community, because you carry an additional burden of this inferiority complex that makes you feel like I am not worth articulating my point of views. And from that then to now, so many young students, researchers, scholars, I would call them, have written and produced critical texts around this discussion.
Absolutely.
So it's motivating. It's inspiring.
Exactly. And that's, I think, that important, and also to be aware of how we might use these platforms, which themselves are situated in a corporate, neo-colonial framework, and then how we strategically use these and work towards coalitions and alignments and the larger dialogue, so that it doesn't become another form of speaking to one kind, only one kind of wizard of Oz, so to speak.
Yeah,
but also it's all each of us individually speaking to the Wizard of Oz separately. But the point there is also, I think this is an exciting moment precisely in different ways, when I see, as I have noted to you and others, I see all of you young people speaking up in different ways through digital publics. So this was a good conversation so far. We are never going to finish the conversation. We are writing. We will continue. We are talking about coalitions, collaborations, co-writing, and we invite others to join us in different ways to talk about this. So thank you very much, Swati, for being a part of this Cyber Diva podcast and joining the team of Cyber Divas. One thing I do want to make clear in the context of how we are doing this is, this is not a technically superb recording. It's not going to be fantastic, but I would encourage people to listen to us and see what thoughts are being produced, because these are, in terms of interactions and thoughts, the guests such as yourself bring, enrich the conversations, and that's the point of the podcast. So you may have editing flaws here and there, and some of us have different background noises. Maybe it's my neighbor running a lawnmower, or if I'm recording from the office, it might be my office neighbor meeting with students or something of that sort. So all those things are going to happen. I am resigned to that. But the point that Swati raised about how we work together is important. So this podcast, for instance, in the context of the increasingly, this phrase that's increasingly circulated, pass the mic. It's not me really that's holding the mic. I'm just saying, let's do this. So in that sense, I basically want to tell the audience here that I'm sitting here with the virtual mic and the recording structures to put out there. But Swati and I have talked a lot before this podcast, and we will be talking and writing after. And much of what is said in these podcasts is indeed defined by the people who come on the podcast themselves.
Yes.
I do want to emphasize that. So, and as we edit, we may make sure that this is highlighted. So thank you very much to the audience, and thank you very much to Swati. But do you have any last words for me?
No, I just want to take note of for the audience that would be listening to us, is that for me, coming in to speak is also with this agenda of allyship and collaboration. We all need to use the spaces that are offered to us, that are there, to be able to have this dialogue and continue it. This is the way that we will create new discourses, and that would be inclusive, hopefully, and enriching.
Thank you very much.
That's my last words. Thank you very much for this session.
Yours will be the last words, even though I said the last words. So bye. Bye then.
Okay,
bye to everybody. Bye. Bye.